You are listening to Dishin' and Swishin', the world of women's hoops on hoopfeed.com.
Hi, everybody. This is David Siegel welcoming you to this week's Dishin' and Swishin' podcast on hoopfeed.com. It is definitely time for the NCAA women's basketball tournament. The conference tournaments are winding up. We just finished with some great basketball in the Big East Conference with a tremendous final between UConn and Notre Dame. And now it's time to start looking forward. And the preeminent person to discuss looking forward when it comes to NCAA women's basketball tournament is Charlie Cream of ESPN, the expert bracketologist from the ESPN.com. And he is our guest this week. So I welcome Charlie to the show. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks for having me, David. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Now, first question is, at this point, we can pretty much confidently talk about where things are going to go, right? Because other than, say, Delaware has still got their conference tournament going, anybody else is going to be a one and done. Nobody else has that kind of equity built up that they're going to make the tournament if they don't win their conference tournament.
Well, except for maybe Green Bay. I would put Green Bay in the field as well. If Green Bay happens to lose in the Horizon, I think they've built up enough as well to get into the field. I mean, I have them in the kind of the seven or eight seed range right now, and obviously that would be good enough to put them in as an at large. But those are the two leagues. You nailed it with Delaware, that the proverbial bubble teams should be keeping an eye on in case one of those two teams were to lose. That obviously open or steals a pit from somebody else.
This is true. You are correct about, of course, the Horizon is still playing right now, and Green Bay would definitely be one of those programs that has earned the right to make the tournament as an at-large if possible. You know, to give people a little bit of a quick background, first of all, you know, this isn't something that you're growing up and you're saying, I'm going to grow up and be a bracketologist. You know, how did you first get started in the studying of the tournaments and, you know, the idea of, you know, this could be kind of fun to project out the women's NCAA tournament brackets?
Well, it's somewhat of an interesting story in that I was working alongside a much more well-known bracketologist now in Joel Lenardi. Back in the day, I guess back in the day, it kind of sounds like I'm a real old man now, but in the early to mid-90s, he and I were together, well, amongst a bunch of other writers, we're working on a hard copy tournament preview that we were trying to get into the hands of people through Blue Ribbon Basketball Yearbook that Joe was the managing editor of at the time. We were trying to get this publication. This is before the internet. Now I really am sounding like an old man. But to get that in the hands of people from a Sunday selection to a Thursday noon tip-off was a little bit of a challenge. So we would try to get a head start on which teams were going to be in the tournament. Well, one year, and this is the men's tournament who we're talking about. One year, the committee threw a couple of curveballs, and Manhattan and Santa Clara were made at-large teams. We were anticipating that. Having deadlines to get stuff to publishers, if you didn't get it in their hands on time, it wasn't going to get out to the fans. The whole thing was going to be a disaster. So we were scrambling. So the following year, Joe decided that I've got to figure out this process a little bit better so we don't get surprises like that. So he started sort of forecasting with a little bit more sophistication and tried to mimic what the committee was doing. So really the idea just being so we weren't burdened with a heavy deadline pressure and trying to get this book out to everybody. That is the birth of bracketology right there. He found it intriguing and interesting, and he kind of went out and once the internet kind of grabbed a hold of a year or so later, he created his own website, and I was there helping him, and I would do supplemental information writing for him. And when it came time for when ESPN really got interested in the information, they brought him along, and instead of having his website sort of compete with them, they just brought him in. A couple of years after that, when the women's coverage started to really expand, they were looking for somebody to do it on the women's side, and Joe sort of recommended me, thought it'd be a natural fit since I was keenly aware of how the whole bracket, at this point it had a name of bracketology that he'd given it. I was keenly aware of how everything worked, that I would be the natural candidate because he just didn't have time to handle both the men and the women. And I guess that's sort of how it was born. I was actually, at the time, I'd left the womb of Joe and moved from Philadelphia and was working in television and covering the University of Maine women's basketball team. So it was sort of a nice synergy of my bracketology knowledge and then my coverage of women's basketball.
So you had been a fan of the women's game right alongside this. It wasn't just a case where, you know, okay, now they needed somebody to look at the women's team and you just started on it.
Exactly. I'd been a fan of the women's game. I was covering the University of Maine at the time. They were a very good program, very good mid-major program. They were perennially dominant in the America East. They actually, one year, they knocked off Stanford in Stanford in the first round of the NCAA tournament as a 15 seed, I believe. And the coach was Joanne McCauley, who right toward the end of my time covering the team jumped to Michigan State, and of course now she's at Duke. So that she's one of the reasons why that program was so vital and successful, because she's an outstanding coach. And that's really was my – I really was deeply immersed in women's basketball for covering that team, those teams. And, yeah, so the, like I said, my interest in the women's game and my interest in brackets came together very nicely when ESPN was looking to do something a little bit more on the women's coverage.
Now, how early in the year do you start actually assessing what's going on with teams, watching games, looking at the possible relationships amongst teams? Yeah, how early in the season does that all begin for you?
In terms of the watching games and looking at teams and evaluating, it starts right away. As soon as they tip off the first game, I'll start kind of keeping an eye on things because it really is a whole body of work with these teams. So what they do in November, it does have impact on where they're going to be in March. But in terms of really kind of putting things together, I'll actually start. One of the processes I go through is most years I'm able to attend the Final Four. So during my downtime at the Final Four, I will start looking at next year already, and I'll start to formulate at the very minimum a top 25. And now, of course, so many things change during the off season with transfers and injuries and coaching changes and things like that, that it's certainly not. I use pencil when I do this, so way in advance top 25. But it gives me a sense of, okay, who might be good, who had a lot of people back, who are already potential preseason number one seeds, that sort of thing. So I guess you could say the process goes all the way back to before the previous season's even over, but it really begins in earnest the second they throw the ball up in November.
Well, they start printing your brackets on, and you modify them perpetually on ESPN's website. And, the first thing now, getting into a little bit of the nuts and bolts, that people have to understand, that I think people sometimes get confused about, is until the committee actually sits down, each of the four regions, who they're going to play really is not defined. Just because you lay out, say, currently a Bridgeport and a Spokane on the left side and a Norfolk and Oklahoma City on the right side, it may not end up that way.
You're absolutely right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I get that question a lot. Why would you have Notre Dame and Baylor playing? You know, that doesn't make – you're right, it doesn't make sense. But we really have to lay it out in some fashion. And it's really more of the template's already built. It's already in there. But the committee will put the regions matched based on the order of the top four seeds. And they'll do it in the proper way. It's really more of a mechanical reason why the presentation is such on the website.
Yeah, I mean, it's just meant to look like a tournament. You could just as easily right now list them four side by side, because that's about as relevant as this is going to be until they actually decide who's going to face off with who.
Right. The purpose of what I do is to show you the 64 and the matchups and the locations in which those games are going to be played. Beyond beyond that first line of every region, what I'm doing is irrelevant. I'm not trying to set up, you know, who's going to – I'm not trying to predict who's going to win games in the tournament. I'm merely trying to predict what I think the tournament's going to look like. So, yeah, you're right. We could just do separate pages for each region, so it wouldn't look like that. We just decided we wanted to put a bracket together that with a full bracket you could kind of get in one glance, and that's really the sense of it. But you raise a very good point, because I do get that question occasionally that the way it looks doesn't appear to make a lot of sense, and frankly, yeah, it's true. But once the template is laid out, just from a web standpoint, you kind of have to stick with it.
It's a tournament. It's got to look like a tournament. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what it's supposed to look like, is a bracket. You know, that, so it's you know, set up nicely for people to understand how at least that it works in terms of, you know, the people playing against each other. That's the important thing. Now, the other thing that, if you could explain for a second, that people really seem to get in a tizzy about that they don't understand, is the concept of a procedural bump. Now, granted,
yes,
this year, I think right now you have about 12 procedural bumps, and I've never seen that many be necessary. I think
exactly.
This goes hand in hand with a column that you recently wrote about how this is such a difficult tournament to project out as the seedings and locations.
It's because of the host school situation. That's the uniqueness of the women's bracket versus the men's, and I think that's where a lot of the angst comes from in fans, is because their mindset is on how the men's tournament has always worked, and they're not taking into consideration that the women's tournament works very differently. And this year for the last four or five, they've had these predetermined sites, and they've had 16 of them. This is the first time in that time frame where 15 teams who serve as hosts, who have to play on their own home court, that being the big difference in the men, are in the field, or are probably, you know, in my mind, in the field. That takes away a lot of flexibility in terms of the bracketing. Some years you could say picking the 64, you know, getting down to those last few, that's the toughest part. Some years you could say, getting the seeds right, because so many teams are maybe bunched in close in terms of their profiles, that's the toughest part. This year, I think without question, it's the bracketing that's the toughest part. And that you made note of all those procedural bumps. Yes, a rule is in place that the committee is allowed to move a team off of their natural seed line by one. So if a team will earn the sixth seed, anywhere you would place them on the bracket would conflict with them playing a conference foe too early, that is before the Elite Eight, or because maybe they're a host and all the three seeds are hosts as well, so you couldn't put them in the same sub-regional. So something has to give, so you would have to then move them a line, and that's where those procedural bumps come into play. And I think to give a specific example this year of how this works and how it maybe seems unfair and a little bit of the backlash I've gotten is Michigan State. They, on my board, come in as the best, what would be the best number 7 seed, so 25 on the overall board. However, so they're very close to being a 6. They're one spot on the board away from being a 6 is essentially what that means. But because of reasons not their fault, out of their control and out of everybody's control, they can't be placed on that 7 line. So they had to be bumped to an 8. So here they were, what would amount to very close to being a 6, and now they're an 8, and it seems patently unfair. And if you're a Michigan State fan, if you're a member of the team or the coaching staff, you're probably saying, that's terribly unfair. But it happens every year to somebody. This year, Michigan State's not going to be the only one, and it is unfortunate, but it's not unique. It's part of the process. It's part of the game. And as I say to fans, look, someone's going to have to do it. So it just happens. This is your team's turn, and the committee tries not to do that over and over with the same program. There is a conscious effort that's done there to avoid doing that. But some years you run into such a bind with the procedures that maybe 2 years in a row a team does get bumped, the same team, and it's not a conspiracy theory against any particular team. It just has to happen that way.
Yeah, in particular, it seems that the Big Ten happens to be the conference that this year it really falls into, with Nebraska being a 4, being bumped up to a 3, yet the teams that went further in the tournament, Purdue is a natural 6 down to a 7, and Michigan State, as you mentioned, a 7 down to an 8. They just happen to be the ones this year, that conference.
It does. It's nothing against the Big Ten. It's not like I sought that out, because I don't look. I just look at them as teams. I don't even really place too much weight on what conference they come from. But that's exactly just circumstance. And the Nebraska Maryland situation, the flip flopping those two, I was. This is the essence of why this year's bracketing is so hard. I would never, and I believe the committee would look at it the same way, would never consider shifting seeds that high in a bracket. But I look at it a number of different ways and trying to get this right with all of the other factors involved. And two things, it kind of came down to, after hours of analysis, it kind of came down to two things. Either that switch was going to have to be made, or Notre Dame, as a number one seed, the number two overall seed on the board, was going to have to be placed on a potential road second round game. And I took the stance of, I think the committee's priority here would be to give Notre Dame the benefit of the doubt because of their status as a higher seed, and try to avoid putting them in a road game situation. Putting them in the only truly neutral sub-regional, which is Columbus in this case, and that they'd sacrifice the idea of having to switch two seeds that were a little higher than you would ever like to do.
Well, it's a good thing Ohio State didn't perform the way that people had anticipated, isn't it?
Yeah. In some ways, Ohio State making the tournament would have made my job easier, because there's no wiggle room. There's no either or. Notre Dame would have to be playing somewhere on the road, whether it was Columbus or someplace else. In one way, yes, it gives me that little bit of flexibility, or it allows for the idea that none of the number ones are going to be playing road games. But as I said, if Ohio State had made it, it would be like, hey, my hands are tied here. Nothing I can do. The math is such that they have to be playing on the road.
What do you think of the predetermined early round sites? I mean, is that something that they should really, in your opinion, get away from as soon as possible, or stick with it, or what do you think about that?
I think it's probably done its time, and it's time to move on from it. I understand why they have it and why they do it, and there's reasons that they give. But by having predetermined sites, they're sort of trying to say two different things or play two sides of the fence. They would like to be able to present the tournament as a neutral tournament. But at the same time, if it was a truly neutral tournament, well, I think we all know that attendance would suffer tremendously, and that would not be good for the game. So they're trying to do a little bit of both, and that really, that I don't think it's really worked. They tried it. It's been a few years now. I agreed with it when they tried it back then. You wanted to see how it worked. I think it's probably past due on its effectiveness, because they haven't completely solved the attendance issue, and they certainly have created a tournament where fans gripe every single year that it's not fair. Or coaches gripe, why do we have to go on the road? Remember a few years ago when Texas A&M was sent out to Spokane and played Gonzaga in the second round, a pretty good Gonzaga team. Gary Blair was none too happy. and they lost, and A&M lost the game. And those circumstances create, I think, in a lot of fans' eyes, sort of an eyebrow raise as to, you know, what's the real priority of this tournament? And if they went to just making the highest seed in each sub-regional the host, I think that would solve that problem. They used to do it that way. They talk about, well, we like to have it set up, so we'd like to give the places that are hosting a little more time to have things set up. I understand that. I've never set up a tournament. I don't know the logistics that go into that, so it would be unfair for me to talk about that angle. But I think since they were able to do it before, you know, I got to think they'd be capable of doing it again. It's probably the place to go. It would make conversations like this though a little less relevant. So it would make me a little less relevant because the bracketing part is some of the intriguing stuff. If all the higher seeds were hosts, then it wouldn't be nearly as interesting. So maybe from a selfish standpoint, I'd like them to stick with it.
You know, the other thing that always goes, it gets people's gumption and gets people a little bit upset as they start going is, you know, they talk about the S-curve and they preach the S-curve. And then they take a look at the S-curve and they say, you know, geography and the cost of this travel has to come into play too. And then they remove the S-curve and trump it with geography. So, you know, what are your thoughts about, you know, the fact that they do that from time to time and the fact that it's created some matchups that perhaps shouldn't be taking place when they do?
Yeah, it does. It, especially as we move along in the tournament, a lot of times it creates a, you know, like a one seed, maybe the, you know, with an S curve, you'd have the true S curve. You'd have the fourth number one seed in this case this year. Stanford is the example. It would definitely be placed with the number one, the best of the two seeds, which in this year in my mind is Duke. But from a geography standpoint, that means sending Duke out west, and as you mentioned, they're not doing it anymore. So it's an S curve with a question mark with a G in parentheses probably is really the more. But I get why they do it. Again, it's cost. There's cost issues. It's economics. It's can fans travel to these games? Would Duke fans go to Spokane to see them play two games over what amounts to a long, long weekend? I don't know that they would. You know, and they can never get it perfectly because there's always somebody that has to travel regardless. But so I get why they do it, and I almost don't know that they in this environment they have much of a choice with that part of it, because the men are kind of doing it that way too now. Their S curve isn't true. I'd like to see it be completely. I hate to use the word fair, because fair again is it depends on what perspective you're coming from.
Yeah, it's a relevant term. That's for sure.
But I'm kind of mixed on this. I kind of sense in my answer I'm kind of hedging a little bit because I get it and I've come to understand. I didn't like it at first. I'll be honest. I had some real problems with because it was the first year they did it. They didn't really make it known that that's what they were going to do. It sort of really sprung it on everybody, and you look at the bracket and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. I think I wrote a fairly scathing column saying, how is this? And then it was explained later on that they decided to go to this more of a geography-friendly placing of teams in the bracket, and I get it now, and I guess I've accepted it. So, initially I wasn't at all a fan, but, you know, I'm not so dug in on it that I don't understand that economics does have to play a role in some of this.
Would it make sense under these circumstances? I know they try to avoid. Yeah, they're caught in a catch-22 when it comes to conferences. When you plug that into this equation too, I know they don't want to have, say, for example, a Stanford-Cal matchup in the Final Four if they could avoid it. But then at the same time, they end up moving Cal to a further region than Spokane, most likely. And then you have, say, a number three like UCLA. You have to have somebody from the Pac-12 is going to end up out there.
Yeah.
So you kind of get caught in your own web, it seems.
Yes. You bring up this circumstance very specifically you mentioned about is one of the dilemmas I'm having is, you know, really, would they put Cal as the two in the Spokane region? Because it does follow the rules that are in place. It does prevent conference foes from playing each other until the Elite Eight because they wouldn't meet until the Elite Eight. It doesn't conflict with any sort of hosting situation, and it follows the geography very strictly. I just don't know how they're going to view it. And I think that's my dilemma. Is I've gone back and forth on this. Well, what if they see it with a heavier slant on geography here, and they put Cal there, or you know, is Cal the team to move? Does Shaquel be rewarded by staying closer to home because they're higher on the board, or should they be rewarded by being moved away from Stanford because they're higher on the board? And is UCLA the team that has to go with Stanford because they're lower, or is it rewarding them? That's a huge dilemma for me. I've gone back and forth on it. This is what I've come up with that I think that they would do, and it's based largely on the fact that the couple of times recently where they have gone strictly by geography, when you have a one and a two from the same conference, and they've placed them that way in the same region, the outcry has been fairly loud. Yeah. And then they reversed their field the very following year. They've done it, like I said, two years ago, I believe it was. They did it with Baylor and Texas A&M. And
I think my ears are still ringing from Kim screaming.
Oh, exactly. It was not. And then one year prior to that, they had done it with Connecticut and Rutgers. But then the following year, after the Connecticut Rutgers thing, I'm sorry, I don't have the specifics in front of me, but I remember thinking, okay, are they going to do that again? Because there was a lot of discussion, negative discussion about that circumstance. Are they going to do it again? And they did not do it again the following year when they could have, if I remember right. So then we fast forward a couple more years, and they did it again with A&M and Baylor, and the outcry was even greater, considerably greater. So then last year, the 1-2 situation didn't manifest itself. There wasn't a circumstance where that would have happened, but there was a 1-3 situation that should have happened. If I recall, it was A&M again would have been the 3, geographically speaking, with Baylor in Des Moines.
Yeah,
but they didn't do that, and then Delaware was a 3, and they were ultimately placed in Des Moines, but Raleigh certainly was much closer. So if they were following that geography, those two would have been switched, but of course that would have been the same kind of outcry against that circumstance. So they apparently listened to the negative reaction from the year before and avoided it the following year. I'm just not sure where they're going to sit on it this year.
In talking about we were talking about Spokane, and we mentioned Stanford and Duke, and why is Stanford considered such a lock over Duke? I naturally, you know, it just seems like I don't hesitate to think that Stanford should be the number one seed too. But when you look at the numbers and you actually start thinking about it, other than the fact that they did beat Baylor, granted without Sims, Stanford's numbers are really close to Duke, and they're both conference champions.
It's true, and I guess the reason because there aren't that many vast differences, I think you start to look for them. And I think the big one is the Baylor win for Stanford. That's the big thing that really stands out. Is Duke doesn't have that kind of win. Duke's, and I wrote about this a long time ago, early in the season. Duke was the one in that grouping of kind of elite teams. They were the one that hadn't been exposed to the rest of the group. And then when they finally were, Connecticut ran them out of the gym. Now, Connecticut ran Stanford out of the gym as well, but Stanford had already established themselves with the Baylor win. And I think that right there is the difference. I mean, it's and then Duke's loss to Miami very recently too hurts them. I mean, if you want to look at the Stanford losses, are of higher quality than Duke's,
right.
and that's really splitting hairs, because I totally acknowledge that, but I think that. When you're really trying to evaluate the differences, you've got to look for something, and I guess those would be the two rationales behind it.
And it really is one of those strange years where A beat B and B beat C, but C beat D and D beat A. They all seem to, between Baylor and Notre Dame and Duke and Connecticut and Cal, they all beat each other, it seems. So
that doesn't make it any easier, also. But that flip flops. Now, if it was a true S curve situation, that flip flop wouldn't matter in the grand scheme of things, because Stanford would just be the number two in Spokane, because they would be the four and the five on the board. But because of the geography question, it wouldn't matter. I take that back. It wouldn't matter in the geography situation either, because Duke would have to go to Spokane as the one, because that would be the only region left for them to go to. And, of course, Stanford would have the first pick of geography coming back, and they would be put in Spokane as a result. So they would just be in either situation. If you were to say that Duke's the number, they would end up both in the same region. Where the difference is made is that now that they're not in now that Stanford was the one, the Duke, they don't end up in the same region. And I guess that's where the difference plays, is that Duke and Stanford would be placed together if Duke were the one and Stanford were the two. Since Stanford's the one, the Duke Nuggets first pick of geography coming back, and of course they're going to go to Norfolk instead. So there, I guess there is a difference based on that decision. I don't know. It could impact the tournament for sure. But I think the rationale behind Stanford being the one and Duke being the two is pretty sound.
Yeah, I mean, if you look with the screen, sure.
That's definitely something that's going to be talked about in that room, I rest assured.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it was a straight S curve, then it would just be what color uniforms they're wearing in Spokane.
Exactly.
But that's not how it works. We know that. Now, a question about there's been some trends that were pointed out to me, actually, and I was just curious. Every team from a major conference that has a winning conference record seems to always get in. If they have an RPI that's better than, say, 35 or things like that. Are these things that just happens, or is it things that the committee has now started to take into consideration, a lot more than people are thinking, since people don't know what actually goes into discussion in that committee in those closed sessions?
I think it just happens, just because of the process. The process is just at least in terms of picking the teams and then organizing them on the board. It's just it's a series of votes. I mean, there's a lot of discussion, but the end decision is made via a vote, which is semi-private in terms of, they each have computer screens in front of them, and they have a group of teams that they're discussing, and everybody's providing the information that they know and their opinions perhaps. And then they have to just, okay, then the person in charge of the room has to say, okay, we have to vote on this group of teams. And maybe it's a group of eight teams, and they vote, and they take they each vote on their computer, and then a main computer kind of tabulates the votes and gives them an order of those eight. Well, they take those first four, and they'll put them on the board in that order. The next four kind of get thrown back into the pool, and then they go through another series of discussion and vote and things like that. So it's not someone stands in the room and says, okay, everybody who's 9-7 in the Big Ten is in. Now we just have to decide where to put them. Does everybody agree with that? And then everybody's a yay or nay. That really kind of conversation doesn't really take place. At least I was in a couple of the mock brackets, and even for us, lay people, that's how the process worked, and those conversations about specifics like that, like, okay, everybody, the six majors who's top 40 in the RPI is in, that wasn't ever brought up.
Yeah, since ESPN runs the world, how come we haven't seen the UConn-Tennessee pairing and the Connecticut-Delaware and the A&M Baylor coming back this year? I mean, I thought you guys said who everybody was going to play. At least that's what I've been told.
Well, I'm not in charge of programming and don't have any role in that, or no one's even really asking my opinion. But the Connecticut-Tennessee thing, I think we all know, runs deeper than anything that ESPN can negotiate. Maybe someday we'll see it again. I don't know, but I think that's a unique circumstance unto itself. I wouldn't be surprised if Baylor and A&M start playing each other again. It just may have been too soon to work it into the schedule, you know, because schedules, you know, it's not entirely, but largely are made ahead of time. So I could see that game being made again down the road.
Yeah, but what about the committee selection? I mean, why haven't the committee made these happen? Are we going to see in Bridgeport? Are we going to see Connecticut, Tennessee as a 1-4?
You know what? It could happen. I don't think they intentionally. Well, in fact, I know, having done this so many times myself, you know, the committee does it once a year. I do it, however, 8 times a year, 10 times a year, whatever it is, and multiply that by the 10 years that I've done it. It's hard. It's hard to put this bracket together. And this year, I mean, we talked about it already. It's really hard to make it work. To add into the mix of, boy, that would be cool, or let's get these two coaches against each other because they both used to coach at their respective other schools. Or there's no way. All these other rules. Just the other night, just following all the rules and the procedures, and having like the aforementioned goal of Notre Dame really should be playing in Columbus. Just taking that into consideration took me hours to wade through all the different incarnations and get it right. Well, get it what I perceive to be right. And there's still probably some scrubbing I need to go through and do on the bracket and say, I need to try to fix that, or I don't like that, or I'm not really sure the committee would do that. And that'll happen probably the beginning part of this weekend. So Saturday and Sunday we'll have the final draft of my bracket. But that stuff is so difficult in itself to manage than to say, okay, we got to figure out a way to get Tennessee and Connecticut together. It's impossible. It really is. And then, because also the geography thing, sometimes you'd be violating that, and then it would really look manipulated, and then people would start to wonder, well, if that appears to be manipulated, what else is manipulated? And then you've opened up a can of worms of conspiracy theory that we'll never ever dig out of.
How much does the committee look at the historical success of some of these programs? It seems that, you know, when you look at, not just on your brackets, but when they actually come out, you see some of the bigger names in the mid-majors, say the Princeton, Marist, Green Bay, Delaware. Well, Delaware is an exceptional case. We won't count them. They'll end up in that 7 to 10, maybe 11 range, along with the middle to lower BCS conference teams. But then the other mid-majors can't get above that line, which always puts them in trouble of extinction in the first weekend.
The mock selections I've done, historical stuff never came up in conversation. I think really what it more goes to is, these programs are just that good. The Colonials offers a little bit better competition for Delaware, or Princeton, the Ivy doesn't, you're right. The Ivy really doesn't offer much in the way of competition for Princeton. But Princeton will schedule a little bit in the non-conference, so it gives their power numbers a little. And occasionally they'll beat somebody, or they'll be very competitive at least in the non-conference against somebody. It's usually the lower tiered, you know, they seem to be the same lower tier all the time. It's usually because they don't. Maybe they can't. I don't know the inner workings of some of these discussions about scheduling, but they don't usually schedule anybody of note. Or if they do, they just get mopped up with. And so the committee doesn't really have anything to go on. So I don't think it is so much of history. I don't think it's an overt discussion. Now, to back up a little bit, those 10 people are human beings. I'm a human being. You're a human being. When the voting process is taking place on an individual member of the committee's basis, who's to say that recognition of a team like a Princeton, recognition of a Green Bay because they've had some success, or a Gonzaga, doesn't seep into their consciousness and say, "Well, I'm gonna vote in this grouping. I'm gonna vote them." I don't think it's overly, they're going to sit there and say, I'm going to vote them in because they were good 2 years ago in the tournament. But it could be a subconscious thing. And that could, if enough people voted with that subconscious trickling in, maybe that's why you see the trends that you mentioned. That's based on what I've been told and what I've observed. That's my only way of maybe explaining it if it needs explaining.
Yeah, because it does seem to become a little bit of a cycle in the fact that, you know, those teams then do start to get some tougher games scheduled, in addition to the fact because those teams are now, you know, a little bit of a name to play against, and that then builds their RPI, and, you know, it all feeds on itself that these mid-majors tend to either rise or fall based on their success in the postseason in a lot of ways. That's one of the things that I always like to try and keep an eye on to see, you know. But on that same note, switching over to, you know, the bubble, as you've talked about, there's not that much this year. But say Florida Gulf Coast is one of those programs that obviously, you know, it doesn't seem to have built up that equity yet that they could afford to lose in their conference tournament and still make the big dance.
Yeah, it's Florida Gulf Coast is interesting this year because, you know, let's be honest, the Atlantic Sun's not good. It's not a good league. There's a lot of sub-300 RPI teams in that league. So how do you really look, how do you evaluate them? They beat LSU. That's the thing that jumps off. If they didn't have that win over LSU, I don't know that we'd even be mentioning them, but they did, so I think they're worthy of discussion because they proved that they can play at that level. Now, with LSU wasn't at full strength that day, you know, so that plays into it a little bit too. But nonetheless, you know, Atlantic Sun team beating an SEC school, you know,
that's news.
It's meaningful. It absolutely is. And Florida Gulf Coast has gotten, you know, from all I've observed and what I've read and been told, they've gotten better as a team. They were a young team. They were for a lot of new players getting more prominent roles, and they've actually gotten better as the season has gone on, and that LSU game was earlier on in the season. So, okay, if you take that on face value and they beat LSU and now they're actually better, well, maybe they are worthy of being in the tournament. But how do we know if they're better or not? I mean, people can tell me that, or I can read it, and, you know, certain people can have that opinion, but what quantitative measure do we have to know that they're better when all they've played are teams that are at the 200s and 300s in the RPI for the last 2 months. So it's an intriguing, I think it's an intriguing discussion, a team like that. Because you said they play in one of the lower major leagues and they haven't, they don't even have any of that equity to bleed into someone's subconscious when they're voting on anything.
You know, and then when you're staying down south but looking in a different direction, boy, you seem to get a lot this weekend about the possibility of South Florida not being one of those teams that did make it in on the bubble.
Yeah, I'm not absolutely confident about South Florida. The last couple teams I have, again, every year I tend to miss one or two, and in the early, kind of the early years of this, I thought, and I would find reasons why I thought the committee made a mistake, you know, that I was right. You know, maybe it's my ego talking or something like that. But in the last few years when I've missed two, I just kind of shrug my shoulders and say, okay, they looked at these teams. I couldn't really determine between these teams either. They were paper thin. None of their resumes were very good. You could find tons of things wrong. You could find minimally things right. They just voted in a different way than I did. I can live with that. It's not it didn't appear to be a huge shift in philosophy. It was more okay, they thought Fresno State was a little bit better than USC. Okay, I can live with that, I guess. Or, you know, something like that. This year with South Florida, I think they're one of those teams that you could say a few good things about them. Then you could question a lot of things. And if they were to not make the tournament, I wouldn't be kicking and screaming. And I hope nobody else would go kicking and screaming saying, well, cream had them in, so they should be in. Well, it's nice of you to say that. Most of those last four teams in, they keep me up at night. I really don't know if I've got it with those because it's so close. But there's not a lot behind them either. And I think that's really what it is with the bubble teams in South Florida being in that mix is it's taking the best of the not-so-good, maybe. And it's maybe harsh to say that, but you can find a lot of things wrong with all of these teams. And as I said, finding the things that are good is that bucket's a lot smaller. With South Florida, I looked at it like this. They really weren't on they were modestly on the radar, and then they went to Louisville and won. And beating a team at that level is good. Doing it on the road has that much more substance to it. And then they followed it up with a win against Syracuse, who had been on an absolute tear at that point. So that got him on the radar. The Louisville game was one that kind of brought him to the forefront, but it didn't actually put him in the tournament. Then the following up of the Syracuse win did, and then they actually stumbled a couple of times. But what was happening behind them wasn't allowing them to fall out because the other teams weren't winning either. So it was sort of status quo. And then they showed that their overtime game against Notre Dame earlier in the year was no fluke, by playing Notre Dame very, very tough again in the Big East tournament. And while neither game resulted in a win, we talk about RPI and last 12 and top 25 and all these numbers, but we're all fans or we're all observers of the game, I guess I should say. And we watch the games, and you watch South Florida play and that day against Louisville or that day against Syracuse or the game against Notre Dame in the Big East tournament, you say, well, that's a good team. That's a pretty good team. They're not Baylor by any stretch of the imagination, but that's a pretty good team. That looks like a tournament. I hate to use the term eye test because I can't stand. I hear eye test all the time, and it bothers me because it's so. I think it's condescending to say that. Like, you know, my eyes work better than yours in terms of observing the game. But I think there are certain things you can take away from watching and saying that team's pretty good. I think they would be good enough to play competitively in the tournament. So. And nothing else has happened behind them to change my mind, so I'm keeping them in. And that's, I guess, what I just did is sort of walked through my thought process on South Florida specifically.
Well, that's what I was going to say next. I said, you know, that was great. You just actually gave everybody some insight into how people, you know, go about the assessment process and how you look at things and the factors that go into that. You know, and it is interesting that for people to understand that, you know, even though you can lose two games, those two games can help you considerably because of who you lose to.
Exactly. And certainly how you perform. I mean, and that, there's where the difference is in terms of looking at math or the numbers and then actually and then watching the games. Because, you know, when a South Florida plays a Connecticut, they lose by 35, and it helps their RPI. Their RPI jumps because Connecticut's RPI, the way the RPI is designed, they just by playing Connecticut, it makes South Florida's math look better. But if you watch the game, like, they weren't even competitive. They threw the ball away. They turned it over, you know, 32 times or, you know, whatever. But conversely, they play Notre Dame, so it helps their RPI, but they play so well and they take the number two team in the country to, you know, to the last 5 minutes, or they push them to overtime in one case. And you come away with a completely different impression of that team, even though from an RPI standpoint, the games sort of meant the same. But if you watch them, the two didn't equate at all. And that's why we have to add that part to it. So we have to watch the games. We can't, otherwise it's just, you know, it's pulling up pieces of paper and that's not, we all know that's not basketball.
So how many times in the next few days will you reassess and change things?
Oh, in my head, the reassessment process has gone on constantly. I the fact that I haven't really changed anything doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not continuing to look at it and take other things into consideration. And it's the reason maybe things have I haven't changed anything yet is because I haven't quite convinced myself that my initial thoughts weren't the best thoughts. Friday could come around, and Saturday could come around, and Sunday could come around, and I could say, you know what, even though I thought about this for 5 days and came to the same conclusion, this is day six and I got a slightly different one. So I guess it's an ongoing reassessment process. It's not necessarily an ongoing adjustment process. But as I said to someone yesterday, the voices in my head keep talking to one another, and eventually maybe one of them will convince the other one to change his mind.
Well, Charlie, I want to thank you for taking so much time with us today and explaining how this whole procedure works and thought process. I think it's fascinating the way that...
It is. It's fun stuff. It really is. It's my version of chess, I guess you could say, because I'm otherwise not really smart enough to play chess.
Well, you're certainly smart enough to figure out these brackets a heck of a lot better than I can, I'll tell you that.
I really appreciate you having me. It's a great, great conversation, great discussion, and I love putting all this into words. It's a fun time of year.
Congratulations on the success that you're having with this, and as more and more people discover and enjoy the NCAA tournament has a women's game too, I think that you're only going to continue to prosper and grow with this. So I enjoy it. I know my listeners enjoy it. Thank you very much again for your time.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime.